From WIPR, I'm Sheila Cast. We're on the record. In 1683, London Town was established on the South River in Anne Arundel County. It was a vibrant trade point, but faded away by 1800. Kyle Dalton, Public Programs Administrator of Historic London Town and Gardens, says the town's residents were commoners, tailors, indentured servants, slaves.
George Washington ate there once, but he didn't think it important enough to write down. We only know he did because his enslaved valet kept a receipt. So it's not like this town is defined by history. Instead, it's a town of average, everyday people.
How might London Town's residents have reacted to news of the Declaration of Independence? We learn how the historic site is working with the U.S. Marine Corps Historical Company to bring the past to life. It's On the Record after the news.
You're listening to On the Record, the podcast, a service of your public radio, 88.1 WYPR. Find more podcasts online at wypr.org. And tell us what you think. Send an email to ontherecord@wypr.org.
Good morning, I'm Sheila Cast. We're On the Record. On July 2, 1776, the Continental Congress, made up of delegates from the 13 colonies, voted to break away from British rule. 2 days later, they issued the Declaration of Independence. How did word of the Declaration spread? What did landowners, laborers, and slaves make of this decree? This weekend, the U.S. Marine Corps Historical Company will explore reactions to the Declaration of Independence at historic London Town and Gardens in Edgewater, Maryland. Researchers and archaeologists studied the lives of the colonial residents of that town, who they were, how they lived. And here to tell us about London Town is Kyle Dalton, the Public Programs Administrator. Welcome to On the Record.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for being here. Also with us is Gunnery Sergeant Thomas Williams, Director of the U.S. Marine Corps Historical Company. He joins us by phone from his office in Frederick, Maryland. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, ma'am. I appreciate it.
Kyle, London Town was established in 1683. Tell us what the city was like during its heyday.
During its heyday, it was never very big. It was maybe 200 buildings, maybe 400 to 500 people. But it had an outsized economic impact on Maryland. Despite being so small, it was a bottleneck. As many as 8 separate roads gathered there. People had to come through town, which meant that all the ships wanted to come there. You go where the people are, you go where the products are. And the product, of course, was tobacco. Grown through slave labor, tobacco was shipped out by the thousands of tons from the town. It had twice as many tobacco ships stop and pick up tobacco as went to Annapolis, making it the most prominent seaport in the county.
If there was so much commerce there, why don't we today think of that town as opposed to Annapolis or Baltimore as the big shipping place?
Part of it is that it was a single export economy. They were really only dealing in tobacco. They had other goods that came out, but never in very substantial sizes. And also, it was kind of an arbitrary point for a bottleneck. There's nothing geographically on the South River that makes London Town a better spot than, say, a mile or two east or west. And so, when better harbors, like Baltimore, rose up, when people started moving west and there were fewer bottlenecks, the town simply fell apart. And that began right at the beginning of the American Revolution. The last major year of trade was 1760.
So it was already declining in the 40s and 50s?
Yeah, sort of a slow decline, and that continued through the Revolution.
During the period right before and during the American Revolution, the town had few residents. Who lived there?
The town was largely enslaved. By 1776, the town was nearly 60% enslaved. These are both African Americans born here in America to parents of African descent, and Africans. We do know of a slave ship that came to the town in 1760 and sold 333 Angolans in that town. So it's quite likely that among the enslaved population, there were native-speaking Africans, native-born Africans who lived there. The landowners were largely Scottish, but there was also a lot of white unfree labor, convict servants and indentured servants. So the town was largely unfree.
Sergeant Williams, how will the U.S. Marine Corps Historical Company bring to life the reactions of colonial people to the news of the Declaration of Independence?
What we're planning on doing, working in partnership with the historic London Town staff, is we'll be providing interpreting specialists, both active duty Marines and trained interpreters, that will providing through a living history-based concept. This is the idea of putting interpreters in historic clothing to better immerse a visitor in what the message we're trying to get across. We'll be representing a broad spectrum of various people that were part of London Town, the citizenry of London Town, and would have been around in the colonial era. And this will range everything from a Continental Marine recruiting party that we'll be representing coming out of Philadelphia and recruiting to build this new central military force, to active duty Marines representing Maryland State Marines and Maryland State Militia that was recruited in the immediate area and would eventually be designated as State Marines. And along with those, we'll have several of our staff that will be attired in clothing, civilian clothing of the period, representing everything from some of the artisan skills, homemakers, looking at hearth cooking, and the various skills that were being taught and learned to make them much more relevant to the modern visitor. We are going to be talking about the political atmosphere that existed and how, just a few days before, on July 4th, the actual formal voting in of a formal declaration declaring all 13 colonies independent, how that would impact the local citizenry, from the very avid loyalist to the other side of the coin, looking at patriots that looked at a unified nation declaring themselves independent from the country, but more importantly, looking at that middle-of-the-road class of people. And, like, say, hopefully we'll also be looking at the impact on this declaration that we think of today as freeing all people like that, and from the point of view of indentured servants and slaves in London Town.
This is On the Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast, speaking with Sergeant Thomas Williams, director of the U.S. Marine Corps Historical Company, and Kyle Dalton of the Historic London Town and Gardens. This weekend, Historic London Town in Edgewater and Arundel County will mark the American Revolution with musket and cannon firings, rope making, other festivities. Sergeant Williams, I notice you call the Marines participating in this program interpreters, not reenactors. What's the difference?
Yes, ma'am. Reenacting is a very, very noble hobby. But when we talk about interpreters, these are people that have been, although they dress in period attire, they're trained specialists and educators that are not only very knowledgeable in the subject matter base, but in how to present this material to the American public. And what we want to try to do, through these skills, is present to the public is not only the history, which we have a tendency to look at through blinders oftentimes, is to basically show the American public why history is important to them, make that human connection between those people of over 200 years ago and the modern society, and showing how what was happening then is directly relevant to us as a society today. And the reason why we refer to it as interpretation is, again, the farther back in history we go, the less direct information we have. We can't talk to the people then. We can merely go by their correspondence, their writings, and the histories, often after the fact, that have been written down. And all we can do is our best capability interpret what we had to say and interpret to the modern public what we believe is the objective history that they represented.
So this debate that will be part of the activities this weekend, Kyle Dalton, what do you hope that people who watch the debate take from it?
The one thing that I want every visitor to take away from this event is that there are gray areas of history, that people weren't just opposing independence because they were the bad guys. And not everybody who supported independence was a good guy. We want people to understand that there are reasons people believe what they believe, that these are not characters, fictional characters, villains and heroes, but human beings, and that we can better understand that time by understanding that people had different perspectives and that not all those perspectives are illegitimate.
Sergeant Williams, will this be like a one-on-one debate? It sounds like you're talking about multiple voices being reflected.
Yes, ma'am, it will be. And essentially what we're going to be trying to do on one of the linchpin scheduled programs that we'll be doing during the course of the weekend will be a tavern debate. It will be segued into by a Continental recruiting party talking about recruiting local citizenry into a federal service, a Continental service. But that will segue into either a Continental officer or the mayor of the town reading this new declaration that has been declared by the Continental Congress to the local citizenry like that. And that will, again, segue into a third-person guided debate. Now, I refer to as third person because the interpreters, oh, they will be basically focusing on issues of the era, but we'll be talking on a modern basis so it can be better understood by the visitors. And ultimately, like, say, these interpreters or like that will try to draw the visitors in and be part of it.
Kyle, what do you think sets London Town apart from other historical towns?
One of the benefits that we have is we're not tied to a single individual. There's no single story that we're trying to get across. And this is true of certain other historic sites in the area, but there are many museums in this country. There are more museums in this country than McDonald's and Starbucks combined.
No.
Yes, that's true. It's a very competitive field. And so it's necessary for museums to set themselves apart. For many of them, that's sort of built into what that museum is. Mount Vernon, Monticello, Montpelier. All of those are associated with individuals, all of whom are self-evidently important. We, however, are at the dead end of a residential street. We're kind of tucked away, and we don't have any founding fathers there. George Washington ate there once, but he didn't think it important enough to write down. We only know he did because his enslaved valet kept a receipt. So it's not like this town is defined by history. Instead, it's a town of average, everyday people. As I said, the town was largely unfree, mostly African-American, but also indentured servants and convict servants. Even among the free people and landowners of the town, the only surviving building of the town, the William Brown House, it's this impressive mansion built about 1760, which was operated as a tavern. But William Brown himself was just a carpenter, and he never made it. He died almost penniless at his daughter's house. These are people who don't affect history. These are people affected by history. And I think for the average person, it's easier to connect with average people when you're talking about history.
Sergeant Williams, what do you think the active duty Marines get out of participating in events with the U.S. Marine Corps Historical Company?
For our Marines, it's a very positive educational experience because now they're getting a chance to experience what their predecessors experienced, what that Marine was like 250-some years ago. And what the trials, tribulations, sacrifices they had to make, and contributions they would make. And ultimately, those contributions, building on each generation, would lead to the Marine Corps we live in today. And for these Marines, it gives them a much better personal understanding of the roots, where we came from. And we're hoping broad-based, not only our Marines, but we can pass that concept on to the general public.
That connection to heritage, too, is present among the other groups that will be joining us there. The United States Marine Corps Historical Company is our chief interpretive partner for this event. We also work with Ships Company out of here in Baltimore, and many of them are Navy veterans. They're trying to make a connection to the history of the Navy. We work with the 1st Maryland Regiment, reenactors of the Continental Army, and these are Maryland Army veterans in some cases. We also work with a group called the Seahorse, which is representing a Maryland State Navy ship, and their leading member is a former Coast Guard captain. So there are a number of veterans from various branches, all of whom are making connections to the past through this event.
Well, you both really have whetted my appetite to learn more about how the Declaration was received. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely.
Kyle Dalton is Public Programs Administrator for Historic London Town and Gardens in Edgewater, Anne Arundel County. Gunnery Sergeant Thomas Williams is Director of the U.S. Marine Corps Historical Company, which will be participating in the Revolutionary London Town events this weekend. Quick break, and when we're back, petticoats and spatterdashes. We dive into the 18th century fashions that the Marines will be wearing at London Town. I'm Sheila Cass. Stay tuned on The Record.
This is the On the Record podcast, a service of Your Public Radio, member-supported 88.1 WYPR. You can support this podcast and everything you hear from WYPR. Become a member. Come to WYPR.org and click the donate link.
Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking today about some of this weekend's festivities to mark the American Revolution at historic London Town and Gardens in Edgewater, Maryland. The United States Marine Corps History Company will offer living history activities, including a debate between those loyal to the British Crown and American patriots. London Town was a bustling seaport in the late 1600s, but by the early 1800s, the town had faded away. The Marines at London Town this Saturday and Sunday will be outfitted in the fashions of the 18th century, all designed by Beth Hall, Deputy Director of the Materiel Division of the United States Marine Corps Historical Company. Beth, welcome to On the Record.
Thank you.
What resources do you use to figure out the colors and fit of 18th century clothing?
I use three different sources. One is original garments, which will tell me the colors that garments were. Another is paintings or images, and those can be also drawings. And then I also use written information. All of these areas have biases, so you must fit the information together to get a true representation of the clothing that was worn.
What kind of biases?
Paintings are often romanticized, so an individual will look maybe taller or skinnier or slightly more fashionable than they truly were. Written information is often doesn't have everything in it that we want to have. It can be using different terms that we're not used to. A vest could be described as a sleeved waistcoat or a jacket or some other term that we're not familiar with. And original garments are a problem because the colors have faded. We also don't know the age of the individual that wore that garment.
So, in other words, if there was a different fit or way that a garment would have been worn differently by an older woman, say, than a younger one?
That's correct. Usually older women are going to wear styles that are more reminiscent or popular when they grew up. So the things that an older woman is going to wear is going to be maybe 20 years behind what is fashionable at the exact moment that you're representing.
The Marines participating in this living history event wear, of course, different outfits depending on their role. What will those portraying the 1st Maryland Regiment wear?
The gentlemen will be wearing a smock or overgarment called a hunting shirt. And this garment goes over all of the other clothing. It was designed to protect the clothing underneath to keep the grease and the dirt off. So the top garment is the hunting shirt. Underneath the hunting shirt is going to be a white shirt and a cravat or stock, usually linen, around the neck. They'll also have on short trousers. They're called breeches. They end at the knee. They'll have stockings that end above the knee, and then a garment that goes over top of their shoe that is called a spatter dash, and that is to help protect the ankle area and the top of the shoe. You wouldn't want stones to get down in your shoe as you're running across the field trying to do a charge. You want to protect the areas of your stockings that could get snagged.
So that was the Maryland Regiment. What about the Continental Marines? What did their uniforms look like?
The Continental Marines are wearing garments that look more like what we think of when we see paintings of Revolutionary War military. There's a coat that is long. It comes down to approximately the knee. There are turnbacks or lapels that fold back on the garment, and the lapels of the turnbacks are usually a different color than the coat itself. In this case, the coat will be a forest green, and the turnbacks or lapels, cuffs, and collar on the coats will be white. These will be made of wool. They will be wearing a waistcoat or a long vest that ends just approximately at crotch level. They'll be wearing breeches, stockings, the popular shoe of the time, which closed with a buckle. They will also have spatter dashes on, which are the short gaiter I just described, or they will have an over-the-knee legging that just protects more of the leg and more of the stocking. Both the Continental and the Maryland Marines will have tricorn hats, which was a popular head covering at the time.
The uniform of the Continental Marine seemed fancier than those of the 1st Maryland Regiment. How could people afford such a fancy uniform?
It was difficult to outfit a group of men. If the officer who was raising a group of men to fight either for the Continental Marines or for a particular state had the money, he would provide all of the clothing and the gear that the men in the regiment would need. And it was very expensive, but the material that made these garments was more expensive than the cost of the manufacturing. So the construction was less expensive to do than acquiring the wool or the linen that was needed.
That's Beth Hall, Deputy Director of the Materiel Division of the United States Marine Corps Historical Company, here on The Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. Beth Hall recreates uniforms for the company from different eras, including the colonial period. Wool, you've mentioned wool. Wool coats seem like the wrong wardrobe choice for summer weather. Why did soldiers wear wool?
Wool was, especially during this time period and in the 19th century as well, was constructed very differently than what we are used to for wool. It was very tightly woven. It was protective in the wintertime as well as the summer, and these individuals might only get one uniform per year. The wool would help keep the soldiers warm even when it was wet, and we know what it's like to stand out in the rain after you're soaking wet. But the other thing that's particularly helpful for soldiers is that wool will not burst into flame if it is exposed to an ember. So it was actually very protective.
Female Marines will portray civilians in these living history events. What would women have been wearing in 1776?
The women, the young women who will be joining us will be portraying the working class. So an everyday woman would wear a shift is the first garment that she puts on. It's a little bit like a nightgown. It's usually has 3/4 length sleeves. And that garment is the garment that will absorb the moisture and the salts from your body so that your outer clothing is protected from your sweat and the grime that we often get on a white shirt. If you're wearing a white shirt, it's usually the collar and the cuffs that show the dirt first.
So the shift is linen?
The shift is linen, that's correct. And linen is was used because it was so strong. Linen is actually stronger when it is wet than it is when it is dry. So it's a really good garment to wear when you have to launder it quite frequently. So the next garment they would have on is a stay or a corset, and that was the only means of bust support that was available during the time, and it would actually be more comfortable than going without anything for bust support. They would wear two petticoats, which are usually about ankle to mid-calf length, and then they would wear something called a short gown, which is a short jacket. It pins down the front. Buttons were not usually used. They were expensive, and it was much easier to just pin this garment on. Around their neck, they would wear a kerchief. They would usually wear an apron or two. Stockings, either made of cotton or wool, and then a fashionable shoe, and that usually closed with a tie or a buckle.
below the waist, these working class women were wearing basically aprons over petticoats, but not an actual skirt?
A petticoat, it was a term for a skirt.
Ah.
So two skirts. Then usually they would choose whichever one was the cleanest or had the fewest holes to wear on the outside.
What kind of reaction do you hear from Marines when they see themselves in these outfits?
Most of them think it's really cool, and it's a very, very good way for them to understand what the Marines that went before them, that helped create the esprit de corps that they experience now, what the individuals experienced before them. It really helps them understand their own history, and they're very excited to participate.
I really appreciate your painting this picture for us. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Beth Hall is Deputy Director of the Materiel Division of the United States Marine Corps Historical Company. At the On the Record page at WIPR.org, we have links to information about the events marking the American Revolution this weekend at historic London Town and Gardens on the South River in Edgewater. This is On the Record. I'm Sheila Cass. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow.
Thanks for listening to this segment of On the Record with Sheila Cast. You can catch the show on the radio Monday through Friday, 9:30 to 10 a.m. on 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station. And you can support On the Record and all the other public radio programs that WYPR brings to you. Just click the donate link at the top of WYPR.org. And thanks.